Most people think that the gods, they're on the big screen. Thor and Marvel have brought back the gods, and, well, it does feel fake. And that is the question we want to answer today. Where did the gods go, and are they fake? And how do we really understand this idea of, well, almost every culture has the view that there are more than one god? And that's what we want to talk about today. Where did the gods go? This is the Reformed Fringe, where we are trying to put the fringe back into the Reformed. And to be frank, we are definitely trying to reform the fringe. There's a lot of things out there that are not helpful, and we would love to see some sound doctrine put into it. So we want to marry the two. And to be fair, the reason why Doug and I say putting the fringe back in the reform, because if you go back and reread the reformers, they weren't afraid to talk about the angelic realm. They weren't afraid to talk about demons and the involvement that we have in the supernatural. So that's why we're saying put it back in. Your hosts are Doug Van Dorn, who's the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Northern Colorado, which is in Boulder. And I'm John Moffitt. I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee, which is just now, south of Nashville. I just hit an energy bar. And all of moisture is out of my mouth. If you would like to learn a little bit more about what Doug and I are doing, you can go to reformfringe.com. You can learn about Doug's sermons and articles and what he's involved there. Lots of books available. It'll lead you to his website. Same thing for me and the podcasts and articles that I've been involved in. But more importantly, there is a growing online community that I am very thankful for. It's called Reformed Fringe. It's off social media. It's our own platform. You can use an app. And it has pastors and theologians and just regular listeners in there, all sharing ideas, asking questions. We did an article last week we read an article and did a whole podcast on it because someone posted it in the Fringe and we thought it was really helpful. And so this is a great place to go. What Doug and I love about it is that we're not fighting. We're not arguing. This isn't I know how it can feel where you're going to try and share these ideas that you're having on social media. And it is a bloodbath of just horrendous comments. That's not what this is. This is a really good place to go and ask questions and dialogue with other people who are reformed, or we would say reform appreciative. You're not anti-reform theology. You're not going to attack us for it. We'd love to have you there. You can go check that out.
Yeah, that John, one of the few things that we don't do very much is tell people mm-hmm. to like our program. So a question for you about this, because it came up to me from my dad this week. I think he was listening probably to the episode we did last week where he said, hey, like our program. It really is important.
Yes,
and he goes, I don't know how to do that. I said, well, what platform are you on? He goes, well, Apple Podcasts. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't think you can like anything from Apple Podcasts. So when we talk about, you know, subscribing
you can leave a review, though,
to a podcast, where do you do that? Like, is there only some platforms you can do that on? How does that work?
Yeah, Spotify and a lot of your podcast places have a place where you can rate our show. You'd only do that once. But if you haven't rated our show, please do so, because what it does is it tells the algorithm to pull it up higher, because more and more people, they want people to be on their platforms. And so the more people that, if you're listening to a podcast, if you subscribe to it and you rate us, that really, really helps. So subscribe. There's a little subscription that says follow or subscribe on Spotify or whatever podcast platform you're using. For YouTube, if you hit that like button on every episode, it does help the algorithm send it out to more people. And the more people who hear this, I think obviously we think it's going to be beneficial for them. And subscribe and hit that notification bell, because what that does is anytime Doug and I put a video out, you'll be notified and you can help share it. So that's how you would definitely get involved in what we're doing. It does help. Any podcast or YouTube video that I find value in, I always like it, just to one, encourage the people who put the video out, but also to encourage it to be shared with others. So there you go. We're not only doing things online, but we're going to be doing an in-person one-day mini-con. It's in October 30th. So if you want to come to Nashville, it's actually not Nashville, it's South. It's going to be in Spring Hill at my church. We'd love to have you here. If you want to learn more about that, we'll put posting details on that very soon. We're like 6 to 7 weeks out. So the things that we announce now might change later. So just bear with us on this. We're trying to get ahead so we can take a break here coming up. But just go to reformfringe.com. You can learn more about that conference. All right, Doug, this episode, there are times where you and I dialogue about a subject that we're both interested in. And then there are times where I have a conversation with you about something that's in your head. And that's what this is today.
I have no idea where this is going,
and you're not told me where this is going, so this is going to be fun.
Exactly. So I've often had this question, like, everybody was a pagan at one point in time. Mm-hmm. And by pagan, I mean they worshiped the gods. And when I mean say everybody, I mean everybody.
Everybody.
Everywhere you go around the world, China, India, the Middle East, Babylon, Assyria, Greece, Rome, the Scandinavian countries, you come over to the Americas, you go to South America, the Aztecs, the Maya. It doesn't matter where you go, John. Japan, islands of New Guinea, Australia, and the Aborigines. It doesn't matter where you go. Everybody was a pagan and they worshiped gods.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now at some point in time, this changed. Now it obviously doesn't change everywhere. So you still find places today where they do this. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about why that is, I think, at the end of the show. But in our culture, especially in American culture, in the British culture, the British Empire culture of the last 200 years, 300 years, where did the gods go? What happened? They're like gone. How can it be that everybody was a pagan and then all of a sudden nobody's a pagan? And in fact, Christians no longer even believe that there are such things as gods.
Yeah. Doug, can we jump into this for a minute? Just because I have no idea where you're going. So I'm even messing it up right now, but that's fine. okay. So there's a flood narrative everywhere. Like so much so that you can't make the argument it got passed along.
There's 400 plus flood myths around the entire world on every continent.
So, and they do vary as far as like what the characters are, but the story pretty much is the
core
same.
Of the story with the god or the gods saving a handful of people in a boat is the same everywhere you go from a major flood water catastrophe.
Right. So, whether you're an atheist, archaeologist, or Christian, we all agree on that one. There's too much evidence to say that's not the case. Now, I'm not making the argument for like the flood narrative, but what I'm saying is that that's normal. What people don't realize is what you're arguing for is that this is also normal, that all these cultures have their own view of some kind of deity, excuse me, that they're worshiping, or multiplicity of deities.
Multiplicity, yeah. When I say pagan, I'm not just talking
monotheist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And even pantheism in the East with something like a Buddhism or whatever. Whether it's
Hinduism.
Whether it's an atheistic Buddhism or a more, I guess theistic Buddhism is probably doesn't really work, but because it's pantheism. Right. But nevertheless,
that's not the main thing. Right. So study of anthropology, as far back as we can go, paganism is the normality.
Yes, it's everywhere. Yeah, it's the worship of the gods. You know, Buddhism was actually a heresy, I guess, in one way, of Hinduism.
Yeah, because it was the worship of one.
Yeah, I mean, so it was a change that came along later after the earlier polytheism. And this is why you find liberal scholars always arguing about how the early portions of the Old Testament are polytheistic, but then the Jewish monotheistic priests came and tried to stamp out that as much as they could, but they didn't do a very good job and they left remnants of it. That's where this is coming from. It's because all the ancient cultures were polytheistic. Where where did they go?
Right. Because like even in Rome, didn't they call Christians atheists?
Yeah,
because
they were
anti-gods. That's right.
So weird.
Which is so crazy, right? All right. Anyways, so the argument being made is that worship of deities, whether they exist or not, we'll get to that. Worship of deities has been present in human history as far back as we know.
Yeah. So as I've had this thought, this question of where did they go? This was 20 plus years ago. I was watching this TV miniseries on a Merlin, King Arthur Merlin story. It's called The Mists of Avalon.
Oh man, and I seen that advertised.
Yeah, I mean it was old school, but I watched it because I think I mentioned last program Stephen Lawhead. Mm-hmm. So Stephen Lawhead's a Christian fiction fantasy writer,
right?
And he's the guy that I attribute basically to me doing anything in life because I didn't read before I found Stephen Lawhead. I hated books,
dude. And that's Stephen my Lawhead story.
Wrote a at that point in time it was a trilogy of King Arthur, the King Arthur story. And so I was fascinated by this story. And so, of course, if you can have a miniseries on the King Arthur story, I want to watch it. But yeah. This was your classic subversion, because instead of it being the King Arthur story, it was actually the story of the witch, Morgiane, who becomes the hero of the story. That's the way subversion works. You take a story, you retell it, but through the opposite lens.
Right.
And in you doing that, you can create some really powerful points, either for good or for not so good.
Right.
So Juliana Margulies' character, the witch, this is the very last scene of the miniseries. And when I watch it, man, my jaw went, whoa, what? So she's reflecting on the old goddess worship of her people. And she's in a monastery full of nuns. And she's lamenting what has happened to the worship of the goddess and how everything has changed because Arthur came and brought this evil Christianity and stamped out the worship of the goddess. And this is what she says with a flicker in her eye as she's walking around looking at the women. She goes, "Avalon faded from the world of men. Only Glastonbury marked where its wonders had been. The Saxons overran Britain and made it their own, and the goddess was forgotten. Or so I was convinced for many years. Virgin Mary, Mother of God, pray for me." She hears the nuns saying this. "Virgin Mary, Mother of God, pray for me." And then she goes back to her voice. "Until at last I realized the goddess had survived. She had not been destroyed, but had simply adopted another incarnation. And perhaps one day future generations will be able to bring her back as we once knew her. Fade the lights. Go to credits."
No way. No wonder why you probably can't find it on any shows anymore.
You can go and find that clip on YouTube. It's unbelievable. Way. I had the same reaction as you. I was like, what did they just do? That's the ultimate subversion, bro. The ultimate subversion. The old ways aren't gone. They just transformed into more palatable versions of goddess worship.
That is crazy.
Dude. So where did the gods go? Yeah. This is one Hollywood writer's answer to that question. They just morph. And they change disguises.
Yeah.
Now that to me leads to an entire podcast. Mm-hmm. I was watching the Nuggets. They were in the second round this year, 2025, and they were playing the Oklahoma City Thunder, who was the number one seed. Nuggets were four. There's this dude, tall white guy named Isaiah Hartenstein, who played for Oklahoma City, and he had this fresh tat on his arm. And I kept looking at that thing going, the heck is that, man? Is that Zeus? So when you go and you look it up on Google, he'll say that it's a tattoo of Jesus.
Really?
But I'm telling you, man, that thing, whoever was the artist, that's Zeus. That's Zeus. And to me, that's like just another kind of way of how has the worship of the gods, how does it subtly work its way into a culture? Without you even realizing it. In fact, you might even deny it. In fact, you might even think it's the exact opposite of what it really is.
What makes you think it's Zeus?
It looks like the classic pictures of Zeus or the statues of Greek Zeus. And, you know, Jesus, over the course of the years, and there's a whole theory on why this is that's related to the Shroud of Turin. But when the Shroud of Turin kind of became accepted in like the 3rd, 4th century, sometime around there, as kind of this is the burial shroud of Jesus, all of a sudden, all the icons of Jesus were uniformed and they started to look exactly the same like that image that you typically, when you think of Jesus in your mind, you have an image in your head. You kind of can't help it because that culture has done that to us. And this is not it. This is Zeus, dude, man.
It does look like Zeus.
And it's even got like a crown around it, almost like you would see on a Statue of Liberty or something like that. It's very Greek, Greco-Roman.
Well, then he has the all-seeing eye on his wrist. Did you see that?
And so, yeah. And so this is like, where did the gods go? Have they really gone away?
Yeah.
So that leads me into a little discussion about the gods that I think people know this, but I don't know that they really know it. And that is the idea of when you break down the names of the gods and you start looking at, well, what are they? You know, what does this word mean? It becomes really interesting to me. So I had the AI do a table for me, and I had it list all the gods that are related to natural or psychological forces. Okay, so Gaia. What is Gaia? Gaia is the earth. That's just all it means. So Mother Earth, that's the worship of the goddess. She actually appears in the Septuagint, by the way, in a strange proverb. Yeah. Yeah. Uranus, we get our planet Uranus from him. That's where it comes from.
Yeah.
It simply means sky. So sky and earth come together and they have children.
So back up for a second. You just said Mother Earth like it was like nothing, but I've never even thought about that where everybody says it all the time. It's like American, if you say Mother Earth, no one is caught off guard as like, they don't know what you're talking about. Everybody knows what Mother Earth is.
And what is she? She is a goddess. That is the way the pagans worship her. You go and read one of the first two books that Al Gore, who invented the internet, had. I forget what the book is. It was this famous one in the early 90s. And you read him as a, I think he called himself a Southern Baptist or whatever, a good Protestant.
Right.
Dude, it's pure Mother Earth worship. Wow. Total paganism is what his environmentalism is all about.
Oh, 100%. So Mother Earth, and my guess is Father Time is Kronos?
Kronos would be time, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Eros. You know what Eros is?
I do.
What is it?
Isn't it like sexual in nature, right?
Yes, so there's different words that we get in the Greek for love. Mm-hmm. Phileo, agape, Eros. Well, Eros was actually one of the primordial gods with Uranus and Gaia before even the Titans came around. And he is love or desire, or we think of it as lust.
Yep.
Okay, why are you naming your gods after earth, heaven, love? Let's keep going because there's more. Oceanus. That one's an easy one. It's the ocean. Helios. He was a god. Like he actually, in fact, if you look at Hartenstein's tat, Helios kind of is represented the same way. So maybe it's actually a tat of Helios instead of Zeus. I don't know.
Right.
Selene. She's a great character in the vampire series with Kate Beckinsale. That's her name. Selene.
Selene.
What does that mean? It's the moon.
Wow. I thought you were gonna mess with Celine Dion.
These are all titans. Yeah,
right.
Okay. Eos, dawn, Kronos, time. Mm-hmm. All right. Now you get now to the Olympians. What is Zeus? Sky or thunder? Poseidon. Earthshaker. Sea shaker. Hades. What is Hades? We all know what Hades is. It's hell. He's the underworld. Now, it's not just that he's a god of the underworld. It's what the word means. He is the underworld.
Right.
Okay. And you can just keep going on and on. Aeolus, keeper of winds. Phobos, fear. Deimos, terror. Psyche, soul or mind. Why are they naming the gods after all these things? I find that completely fascinating. But when we think of gods and goddesses, I do not think that our first impulse is to go to the meaning of the words. especially, no. I think, probably for Christians, right? Because, and especially in a non-reform fringe context, we're so repulsed by the very idea of gods, we don't even care about what they mean because we're too busy making sure everybody knows that they're not real. So we haven't done our homework on what That's it right. actually is that these people were worshiping. Now, what are these things? Well, aren't they things that God has created, the true and living God has created? Whether it's desires, emotions, forces of what we call forces of nature. Isn't that what they are? But the ancient peoples, they're personifying them. And in fact, they seem to believe that they're not just personifications, because a personification isn't really a thing. It's just a way of helping us identify with a thing.
Sure.
Right? But they actually believe that these things have intelligence, that they have will of their own, that they are actually persons. That's pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah.
To our worldview. Because what do we do with those things? Well, we were talking about enchantment last week, weren't we?
Mm-hmm.
An enchanted world. We were talking about how our current world has been misenchanted. So let's come to our modern context a little bit more, and let's think about the isms of the 18th and 19th century that might be related to this. Rationalism. What did rationalism do? Made everything so that we had to be able to reason about it, or it wasn't real. How about naturalism, where we get the theory of evolution really from? What is that? The explanation that everything has a natural cause, not a supernatural cause. Materialism. What's that? That's the view that there is nothing other than the material universe that we can see and test and attest to. Except for reason. You know? But right. that's nothing supernatural itself. So we have been influenced by all these isms that have desupernaturalized the world. And what has it done to the way that we think about these forces? Right? So if I say wind, what do you think of?
Yeah, you think of power. I'm thinking about it last night, because last night we had a tornado warning coming through my neighborhood. So I'm thinking about power right now.
Okay, so you think about power. So power is a very, at least in a modern way of in under those isms, it's something that just kind of happens, right? I think about weather maps. I think about watching a TV weather channel. That's what I think about.
Sure.
And a storm is blowing over my head because some clouds popped up because it got really humid outside. And it got warm enough that the warm air went high and the cool air stayed low, and, you know, or the opposite way, whatever it is. And
sure.
Then all of a sudden a storm happens, and then the wind is created by the storm, by the clouds. And it's all molecules and atoms, and there's That's nothing else to think about here.
Right. You can explain it.
Right. Mm-hmm. How is a hurricane created? Same thing, right? The warm waters, and that's all we do. Our mind just thinks that way. That's not the way ancient people thought.
Mm-mm.
I'm preaching on Acts 27 this coming Sunday. I might probably mention this on the last episode too, because we are doing this episode on the same day. But that's a whole story about these winds that just kind of keep popping up, and these storms that happen, and God's providence in the midst of it. But if you look at the pagan counterparts to this, it's actually the gods and the goddesses who are responsible for the winds.
Yeah, do you think, I mean, when they say he even controls the seas, that's what they're talking about?
You mean in with like Jesus on the walk in the water?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's even more than that, because let's say that you are a Jew and living in Galilee at the time Jesus walks on the water, and there's a storm that comes up. Well, who do all the Canaanites, Phoenicians, the people around that area, who do they attribute the storm to? Baal, because Baal's the storm god. That's his job, And if you're a Greek, you're going to attribute it to Zeus because they're the same entity. So when Jesus calms the storm and the sea, now, if you think sea and you're a Canaanite, you think Yam. He's the brother of Baal. He's the sea god. If you're a Greek, you think Poseidon because he's the brother of Zeus, the god who's over the ocean. See, you're not thinking about molecules and atoms that get really superheated because they just are colliding because of the weather. You're thinking an entity is behind this. So when Jesus speaks to the storm and the sea, what's he doing? He's showing that he has the power over those gods. They don't have any power at all because he's the most high. He's the high God, and they're powerless against him.
Yeah. So there's so many questions here, but I'm going to make a point and then I'm going to ask you a question. So this is where people will say, you guys need to be careful because you're reading into the text this pagan Eastern view of culture. And it's manipulating the way in which you're understanding it. I said, okay, let's think about this for a moment. You try and read an American history book and you remove American culture from it, you're going to have a hard time understanding that history and why things happened. And you might even actually misinterpret what actually happened because you don't understand the cultural references. I'll give an example. This is a lame one, but I was out to eat with my son. And he ordered the Larry Bird. And he goes, why do they call him this sandwich Larry? Because it was a hot chicken sandwich. And I was like, I have failed as a father. Larry Bird, basketball player, MJ, the goat. You know, you walk around, why do they call these athletes goats? I don't understand that. Like, are they attributing them to be animals? Like, I don't understand, right? Like, no, it's an acronym, right? It's like, he's the MJ. It means he's the greatest of whatever it is that he's a part of. He's the greatest of all time. So what you're saying is there is a culture, there is a understanding, there is a reference, there is a process by which these individuals would have thought and would have engaged in it. Which I'll just make an argument here, Doug. I don't know where I read this recently, but someone was making this argument that how fascinating was it when they thought it was a ghost when they saw Jesus on the water. That was their solution. It's a ghost.
And they're Jews, right?
Right.
We're not even dealing with pagans at this point.
Or when Peter's standing outside the door and it's more logical for it to be his angel than it to be Peter. that is a whole different kind of culture. No, young girl, it's got to be his angel. Never in 100 years would I ever be at a prayer meeting and someone would say that.
That's such a great point, because this is exactly it. When somebody has this comment that you guys are just reading in things that aren't there, actually, it's the opposite. What we're doing is we're reading our naturalism back into the ancient text, presupposing that everybody thought about the world the way that we do, when in fact it was exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. Even the Jews had an insanely supernatural worldview, which is why they weren't prone to becoming naturalists and materialists. They were prone to becoming Baal worshipers and Asherah worshipers.
They even attributed Jesus's miracles to that. They're like, this has got to be the work of Baal. And that's when Jesus says, no, that's blasphemy. If people always want to know what blasphemy is, that's it. To attribute the work of God to the work of Satan, now you're blaspheming the Holy Spirit. But I think it's interesting is they look at it and it wasn't saying he faked it. It's a magic trick. They attributed Jesus's work to a God. And Jesus doesn't deny the fact that they did that. He actually goes on and says, okay, if you guys think this is the case, then he's got a divided house. Why would Baal be throwing up Baal? That doesn't make any sense. All right. So that was my comment. Just to help people understand what you're doing here is you're helping people you're giving insight to how their world was structured, and it was not influenced by materialism. We're influenced by materialism, rationalism. They were not. Here's my question then. So what is the argument you're making? Is that, like in Job, a storm came and killed all of Job's family. That was caused by a deity. Are you saying that storms are caused by deities?
Okay, so what I'm saying is that in the ancient mindset, in fact, let's use Job at the beginning of Job for a minute, and then we go to the end of Job, since you bring it up.
Yeah.
None of this is pre-planned, by the way. I'm throwing this all on you. So that, this is your question.
Welcome to the conversation of two Reformed Baptist pastors.
Okay, so in Job 1, you know, God tells the heavenly being Satan, hey, have you considered my servant Job? And then he's like, yeah, I can't do anything to him because you put a hedge around him and I'm not allowed to touch him. He goes, fine, go ahead and touch him. But you can't, you know, you can't touch him in the first one, but you can touch anything else. So what happens? A storm comes and kills his entire family. Well, now, how do we attribute the storm to coming? Well, this is a Jewish book. We're not even talking pagans.
Somehow,
I don't know how it works. I don't know how they would have conceived of it themselves, but somehow there's an entity in heaven that when God gives him permission to do something, a storm comes and destroys his house.
It's the next part of the story. It's not like, oh, you know, 30 years later, a storm happened to come and God's protection wasn't upon him anymore. That's not how the story is told.
What happens when you come to the end of the book? Okay, so now Job's at the end of his rope and he's about ready to, I think, in my opinion, Job's about ready to just
snap,
blaspheme, and it's over. Yeah. And God comes and he intervenes. And how does he do it? Mm-hmm. He comes in a storm. He comes in a storm. God is in the storm. So in the book of Job, yeah, storms are directly proportionally related to supernatural entities. And this is the way all the ancient peoples thought. Now, how did they think it that way? I don't know. Hera somehow is over Jason and the Argonauts, and she's trying to protect them while Poseidon's son, the Trident, is trying to kill them. With what? With storms.
Right.
That's what they thought.
Sure.
That's how they tell their stories. This is the way that their enchanted world worked. We don't do that. However, and this is kind of where I want to take it next.
Sure.
Whether you attribute a storm to a deity or you attribute it purely to mechanical natural forces, you still have to deal with storms. That's pretty self-evident. So if you decide to deal with storms through purely mechanical means, guess what worldview you're adopting? That's not a Christian worldview. That's a materialistic, naturalistic, rationalistic worldview that came along 1700 and 1800 years after the New Testament was written. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong to do that, John, but I am saying that when you think that that's what causes a storm or that's your explanation for it, you are adopting a worldview.
Sure.
When you say that Zeus caused the storm because he is thunder, you're adopting a worldview.
Sure.
Now, in either of those cases, if you have a biblical worldview, you can counter both of those, and you don't need to go, your answer doesn't need to be, that's because gods aren't real, or that's because nature doesn't really do that.
Right.
Your answer as a Christian is that the Most High, the creator of heaven and earth, is the one who is responsible for creating the wind, the weather, and the mechanisms through which those things can be themselves manifest in local places. Sure. So whether he chooses to do that through purely natural forces, and when we look at the world through the lens of science, that's all science can do is look at it through nature. It's not capable of looking at it through the metaphysical. Mm-hmm. So it's actually not wrong to say that something is created by atoms and molecules being superheated because of the sun or whatever. It's a mechanical, physical explanation. All the gods part of this is a supernatural, metaphysical explanation for the same phenomenon. But as a Christian, we actually believe that God created both the natural and the supernatural, both the physical and the metaphysical. He's the one who's in control over all of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of thoughts here. I'm going to need to get them in quick. Okay. So,
hey, we're only on 35 minutes.
Yeah, I know. I know. Okay, so this is good, and this is you're really stretching some categories here, which is healthy. I think if I were to pitch back to you what I think you're saying, and maybe give you some ideas to develop for the listener, the ancients had a view that the gods were real and involved in our world. And at times they may have attributed more to them than they should have. And I think they may have attributed too much and we don't attribute enough. Is that fair?
It's possible. I don't know that I would agree with that, but it's certainly possible. It's certainly logically possible.
Right. Well, if you're pagan.
Well, okay. Let me put it this way. So I would agree with it in this sense, because all paganism is a denial, fundamental denial, that there is the Most High and that he is the personal creator of all things.
That's what I was.
So they're, yeah, they're working on the level, if you put it in a divine council worldview, they're denying the Most High and they're working all on the level of the 70 sons of God. They're attributing everything to them, and there is nothing up higher than that other than maybe chaos.
Right, which is right. So, you know, when God says he's the one that's over life and death, but we have beings that hold those titles. And so there
the
are times where
death.
Right. Right. Is a great example. Or to even say that Satan holds the power of death. Right. So there are realities and truths. But from a pagan standpoint, if you don't believe in Yahweh, then they're going to be warped by these fallen entities. And these entities want you to believe in them so much. They're going to warp their power, not to say that they don't have it, but so much so that you worship them, right? Which is the ploy of Satan in the wilderness. Just worship me, Jesus. Just worship me and you can have all these things that you're wanting. We're doing the exact opposite, to where we're taking God's created orders, and we are seeing that they do have powers, and we're being warned of those powers. This is what's crazy, Doug. We're being warned of the powers by multiple apostles. Hey, and Jesus himself, Lord, deliver them from the evil one. I mean, this is part of his prayer, his highly lucid prayer, and then tells us to pray it. And we're saying, yeah, that doesn't exist. And so to your point, the gods are always manipulating humanity. And they're either manipulating them to be attributing too much, or ignoring them so they can work in the subversion. They can work in the secrets. They can work in the hidden places, to where they're still causing us to not love God and to worship something other than God. They're just doing it different now. So this is your point of where are the gods?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then take that a little step further with the modern way of thinking about this. So if we no longer attribute a storm to Zeus, but we attribute it to the heat of the sun in the middle of the day, and we think that the sun is not a god itself, but it's a ball of gas in the somewhere out there, wherever it is, then we've desupernaturalized it, but we've also, and we're failing to recognize that this is true, we've actually created another religion. Mm-hmm. It's the religion of materialism, the religion naturalism. And so the common thing in both cases is that we have these forces of nature or these emotional desires that come in human beings or whatever, and we worship them in both cases. And you can pretend that you're not worshiping anything as a materialist, but you are, because you've put that materialism as the highest thing that there is, the thing that created all things. And by every definition, that's a god.
That's right. Yeah, that's a powerful statement, because when you're asking about the origin of the universe, they're attributing the origin of the universe to the universe. I mean, that's what they do.
That's
the
exactly
origin
right.
of the universe is the universe.
And so whether it doesn't matter if it's a form of pantheism or if you have it as a, you know, pantheism and atheism are just two sides of the same coin, man.
That's right.
So my point then is that you can poo-poo the gods all you want, but recognize that the way that you speak of it as a materialist is exactly the same thing. It's a religion. And if you have the storm or the earth or whatever, and you're put just you're, that's the common thing between both of these. And it reminds me of Screwtape, Brian mm-hmm. DeWormwood. And he's like, well, you know, if we, it's just as powerful, right, to have them worship us as it is for them to not even think that we exist.
Mm.
And you kind of made that same point just a minute ago.
That's right.
Right?
Yep. Well, okay. So again, the Bible is not a science book. It's not a math book. What is the Bible? The Bible is the revelation of Jesus Christ to humanity and how we are to live in light of him. Because what does Peter say? Everything that we need for life and godliness has been granted to us by his divine power, right? What does Paul say? That everything that we need to know about our life is found in there. So as it relates to the spirit realm and the physical realm interacting with each other, that is what that book is for. 100%. How do we know this? Because it tells us this is how you get rid of fleshly problems. This is how you engage in the spiritual realm. Those are the two things it's telling you, how to put the flesh down, how to engage in the war. What's interesting, though, Doug, is that the part of the war side of it is only fleshly because we have desupernaturalized the text. And when you're asking, where do the gods go? If you read the text and you allow it, if we do our proper exegesis, and I mean a reformed hermeneutic here, and I will show you where the reformers have this perspective that I do. I read Stephen Charnock last week, who was saying that the angels are always at the ready to be at war because they're battling. I mean, that was his perspective. That was Charnock, who is very conservative Puritan, if you go back and read his works. But his view of our world is that there is a war going on amongst the angels. So to say that the gods aren't real, Doug, to this day, I still don't understand how people try and explain away to me, you shall have no other gods. It doesn't say you shall not make for yourselves any other gods. That's commandment number two. Those are idols. It says you shall not have, which means they're already in existence. And then it explains to you what these gods are by name. Hello. They give you the actual names. And then Jesus affirms their existence, saying that Baal is a real being. Baal shows up in the Old Testament. I'm sorry. I'm just kind of losing it for a moment. But when you, we do this for the gospel, we do this for church polity, we do this for our sexuality, we do this for morality. American morality has gone haywire. Conservative Christians say, I do not get my morality based upon the acceptance of American culture. Praise God for you. Thank you. We get our morality from an ancient book that people mock and make fun of. And say, those are cultural warnings. Those don't matter. You know, homosexuality is not a problem according to the Bible. All this kind of stuff. But yet, Doug, I kind of went on tilt here. But when we go to the supernatural part of the Bible and we look at the world, we go, well, the two don't line up. So I'm going to go with what I can see. And the text over here, it's just kind of weird, and we're going to ignore it. And you're arguing, where did the gods go? They're in the text. They're introduced to us.
What I'm saying is that they haven't really gone anywhere. They've
That's just what my changed yes, thank you.
Their disguise.
So just because you can't see their effects, this is my whole argument. Just because you can't see their effects in the way in which we did before, doesn't mean we were stupid, ignorant people who finally figured it out because of science. No, they've just changed their tactics. They're smarter than you. They've always been smarter than you. And unless you use the truth of Jesus in his word, they're going to always outwit you because you're not smart enough to do this. You have to stand in the strength of the Lord.
Let me give you two thoughts here.
Well, you got me all worked up.
I know. Well, this is a topic that should get us worked up. You know, here's the deal. Zeus worship and Odin worship, as an example, they're back. There is a temple to Odin in the city of Reykjavik in Iceland for the first time in 1,000 years.
Wow.
A literal temple. You can walk in it. You can worship Odin.
Hmm.
So this is like very, very relevant. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I was thinking as you were talking about biblical ethics, why does the Bible forbid certain practices? Well, let's use Eros as an example. Let's say that Eros is the god of lust.
Erotic. Yep.
Yes. By engaging in lustful practices, it's as if you are letting the God out. It's like letting Pandora out of the box.
Out of its box. Wow.
Pandora is not a jack-o'-lantern. She is a goddess that you cannot put back in once you've let her out. I was thinking about the funny 50 song my girls reacquainted me with. Stupid Cupid, stop picking on me.
Oh, my word.
You heard that song?
No.
Oh, yeah. Go listen to it. Stupid Cupid. And then there's a girl who's, you know, high school girls who fall in love. She keeps falling in love with all these guys. She calls him Cupid in the 50s.
Right.
Who's Cupid? He's basically another form of Eros in a way.
I know. Right?
The little chubby angel who shoots you with the arrows. He's a god who makes me bite the love bullet or whatever it would be. Like, these things haven't gone anywhere.
And so real quick, I want to make a connection here, because what you're saying, it's like it might be just way out there. James and Paul do this. What does James say? Resist the devil in treating each other with biting with your words and your tongue. Resist the devil with your mouth, and he will go. You don't do this, and somehow it's welcoming Satan into the church.
That's right. And that's what I'm saying, is that if you have the enchanted pagan worldview, it's much easier to see this, because the gods were actually our passions. So when you engage in your passions, you are effectively worshiping the gods. And that's why from a biblical point of view, this is why it seems so puritanical or whatever to not engage in all of these things. It's because it's something intimately connected to the worship of the gods when we start indulging in these things. But we don't look at it like that, right? Because we're a materialist, and we all know that that kind of stuff isn't real. And so what better way to get people to engage in their passions than to make them not think that they're doing any kind of worship of other gods when they're doing it?
Man, I am thinking right now of 2 Peter. Yes, listen to this real quick. So I just preached this a while back. But there will be false, 2 Peter 2:1, but there will be false prophets also among the people, even as they shall be false teachers among you why am I struggling with it? Because it's in King James. When I do research in the Puritans, I have to go back and do King James, because the quotes won't match up. Okay. But false prophets also arose among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them, bringing upon them swift destructions. And many will follow their sensuality, and because of them, the way of truth will be blasphemed. Did you notice there he connects heresy to sensuality, and it's the false teachers who are bringing them in?
It's always that way. Idolatry and adultery in the Old Testament. It's two sides of the same coin. Idolatry would be the supernatural part of it. Adultery would be the human to human part of it, but it's the same thing.
Yeah. In Galatians, when he talks about the works of the flesh or sorcery, there's a connect. I'm making this connection because he's listing like idolatry, but sensuality, fornication, and he's connecting in this list. Like, oh, this whole thing is also included in sorcery. No one would ever say, hey, cheating on your wife is the same as sorcery. And Paul's like, no, it's a work of the flesh, which there's a connection to the supernatural in what you're saying. Okay. All right. You ready for this? What were the children of Israel doing when Moses comes down the mountain? They were worshiping their God. And what were they doing? It was an orgy.
And yep, basically. Yep. These two go hand in hand, man. And I think what we're doing is trying to uncover the ancient explanation for why that might be the case. And at the same time, to suggest that maybe the modern explanation for these passions and forces of nature or whatever it's not capable of explaining things to the degree or to the right degree of what an older worldview is doing, because we can't understand how idolatry and adultery could be related, but it was no problem at all to the biblical authors of either testament.
Well, if you're so I've made this argument before, Doug, but if you want somebody to not repulse away from what you're enticing them to, you're going to hide the source, right? Where did this come from? My wife has done this before where I say, hey, you should eat this. And she'll ask me where it come from. And then she'll say, don't tell me, I won't be able to eat it. See, she just eats it blindly because she doesn't want to know where it came from, right? Well, this is, I think Satan, he says, he appears as an angel of light. If you knew this was a dark, evil force as a Christian, then you wouldn't engage in it because you're like, oh, that's evil. But we end up becoming enticed by it and we engage in it because we don't think it's evil. The sad part is that the evil side of this, as you're saying, the rise of witchcraft in the United States, they're saying that it's in the thousands of percents. Like, it's insane how many people
are
so...
All forms of paganism. All forms of it.
There's literally a Pagacon. There's a con.
Yeah.
There's a conference for pagans now. Which is different from Satanism, by the way. They do not.
Yes.
They're different. They're not the same.
That's totally true. But they're all forms of paganism. It's really at the end of the day. Maybe we should wrap it up. I guess what I want to say to wrap this thing up, this could actually be a whole another discussion because it would be too simplistic to just say this, but I think it's important to say it. So even though I think that the gods never went away, and I think that that's demonstrated by that quote from the witch in the Arthur Merlin movies in a really powerful way. I've often thought about something else kind of parallel to it, which is the rise of Christianity in the West and, in fact, everywhere that it's gone. So somehow there does seem to be a decrease of the overt supernatural activity when Christianity is strong. I find this really wild. Priests earlier in Acts, a few weeks ago, I don't remember the exact place that you can read about this, but when the gospel started going to the nations, the Gentile lands, so as it's going out into Greece through the missionary journeys, at the same time, and Christians, people start becoming Christians, at the very same time, you will read the Greek philosophers talking about how the oracles no longer speak and how this was the first time in history that this had ever happened. The oracle at Delphi became silent. An oracle is basically just a pagan prophet. Okay. And they weren't talking anymore. Well, why? I think the intrusion of the kingdom of God over the kingdom of Satan has something to do with this. And this kind of goes to the main point that I want to have here, that goes along with our eschatology, John, which is that there really actually is a power over these entities. So whether they hide themselves or camouflage themselves or just come right out in the open with what they are, depending on the cultural context, they're always going to be there, but there's still a power that can bind them from all kinds of mischief. The chief mischief of which is keeping people in spiritual darkness and as slaves to their kingdom. Mm-hmm. So that when the gospel, the good news of Jesus, the fact that the God-man came and indwelt among us and took on human flesh and lived a life of perfect obedience, satisfying God's law, and then satisfied God's wrath in his own willing death on a cross, to be a sacrifice for our sin, and then descends into hell and goes right down to the very gates of hell, proclaiming his victory, rises from the dead, conquering death itself, and then ascends into heaven, where he is seated at the right hand of the Father and has been given all authority on heaven, in heaven and on earth. Therefore, go and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and teaching them everything that I have commanded you. That is a power that actually puts down, controls, stops these evil creatures from being able to carry out the mischief that they otherwise would. And conversely, I really do believe that when the gospel is lost, so also is the power to bind them. Mm-hmm. And so if you see the rise in the West of something that we have not seen in 1,000 years, of temple to Odin, you can bet your bottom dollar that it's because the gospel of Jesus Christ has been eclipsed and the church is no longer proclaiming it. And the church is that singular supernatural power, the power over all things, the power of God to the salvation of Jew and Gentile. The thing that we don't even think is powerful anymore. The thing that Charles Finney thought had to have music playing beside of it and emotional manipulation in order to get people to actually make a decision of their will in order to be saved. No, the power of the gospel is a supernatural power of the Logos itself, the very thing that created heaven and earth.
Hmm.
And so where did the gods go? They never really went away. But when the gospel is present, it has a power over them that I think helps to explain a lot of why they had to change tactics in the West the way that they did.
And to your point, you look at a country like Ireland, who has just absolutely gone almost fully back into paganism. Mm-hmm. You talk to people that are there. Mm-hmm. And it used to be a lighthouse of the gospel back in the day. A lot of Europe. In that way. So to say that the United States and we have been free from a lot of weird paganism that's been kept in the darkness and it's been kept in the secret places, which is where we'd want it to be.
It's where you want it to be. It's never going to go away.
No.
But put it underground where it belongs.
That's right. But now it's not. It's being celebrated in music and movies and politics.
And that's the very reason why we have to have this discussion.
That's right.
Because
people understand.
Yeah.
The solution is Jesus Christ.
What's causing what's happening in our culture today. And I think that this is a major explanation for some of these very serious problems that we're seeing.
We should exegete that passage when Jesus ascends the mountain and says, greater things than these you will do. And he says, talking about stepping on scorpions. Don't think he means stepping on scorpions. all right. Well, what a great discussion. So hopefully you've enjoyed this. Go to reformfringe.com and sign up to be part of our community. And you can also sign up for the conference that is there. No details because we're like 7 weeks out and we haven't planned them. So we will. Thank you guys for listening and we'll see you next week.